The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. Support for The Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering online and online master's degree in health and wellness management. Learn advanced wellness program management skills and make a difference in a rewarding career in partnership with UW Extension. Details at uwp.edu. There's something very appropriate right around the turn of the new year to be thinking about ways in which we can perhaps reshape ourselves, reshape our lives for the better. And one book that may be indeed a very helpful resource for you toward such an end is a brand new book called The Habit Trip, a fill-in-the-blank journey to a life on purpose. The book is written by Sarah Hayes Coomer, who is a Mayo Clinic certified wellness coach, a certified personal trainer, and a nutrition and wellness consultant with the American Fitness Professionals and Associates, the author of two previous books, Physical Disobedience, An Unruly Guide to Health and Stamina for the Modern Feminist, and Lightness of Body and Mind, A Radical Approach to Weight and Wellness. This new book is published by Running Press, and again, it is titled The Habit Trip, A Fill-in-the-Journey, Blank Journey to a Life on Purpose. Sarah Hayes Coomer, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me, Greg. I'm excited to be here.
I think one of the things I especially appreciated about your book is that very early on, you said very clearly who this book is not intended for. That is, there are certain people in certain places in their lives where this book is really not what speaks to them. If you would permit me to just read this paragraph, you write, "This journey is not intended to conquer the rugged terrain of trauma or abuse. Moving through that kind of territory is a challenge that requires the care and safekeeping of a trained guide. This book is not intended to cure serious substance abuse either. It's not therapy. It's a straightforward process of teasing out frustrating habits and playing with them to see what else might be possible." I really love the way you phrase that, but I'm really anxious to hear a little more about why you felt like that kind of word of caution was important to share at the outset of this book.
Well, there's a big difference between handling trauma and trying to enrich our lives. So, you know, we've all been taught to believe that change is a difficult, painful process of primarily focusing on manipulating or depriving our bodies. And this book is all about play and exploration. It's inspired by my love of Shel Silverstein and Dr. Seuss and Roald Dahl. And so I felt it was really important to help people understand that if they're facing a real trauma, they're not going to be able to just kind of uproot that and find their way through it using this book or even by themselves, and that it's just really important to hold space for that and to allow them to find or encourage them to find a professional to help.
Mm. I really, again, appreciate the fact that you take the time to say that, and you say it so well. So if it's not for people in that situation, of course, it is intended for a whole lot of other people. Many of us, in fact, could probably profit from this book. When you think about who would most benefit from reading The Habit Trip, who first comes to mind for you?
Well, I wrote it with nurses and teachers in mind, in my heart. My mom was a nurse, my dad a teacher. So it was for anyone who feels like they are a caregiver. This would involve, you know, parents, anyone who's in a caregiving position who is looking for ways to, who feels stuck, who has wanted to make a change and has been unable after trying again and again and again to do it. And this just offers a different, more playful way to figure that out.
You mentioned that as you wrote this book, you were or are 43 years old. And you kind of talk about how that is an interesting place to be in one's life. And it was an interesting place for you to be in terms of being positioned to write this particular book. Tell us more about what being 43 has to do with the writing of this book and the way in which it took shape.
Yeah, well, I think that age between sort of 35 and 55 is this time when you've been going, you've been at it, you've been, you know, you're trying to build a family or a career or whatever it is that you've been trying to work on your whole life, and you might have arrived at a place where maybe things aren't quite as you hoped, or there are areas of life that are feeling left behind. And so this really gives you a place to land. So you can say, okay, I call it pinning your location in the book. So where am I? What's working? What's not working? And then what do I want to do about the things that aren't working? And at that sort of midlife time, there's so many things going on that it's really difficult to step back and try to figure out where that is. So this helps you do that.
One of my favorite parts of the book is when you, and this is again towards the very beginning, you talk about some of the ways in which we sort of frame our understanding of who we are and how we fit into the world. And we often label ourselves, and certainly probably even more so label others, in fairly simple fashion, that so-and-so is such-and-such, and so-and-so is such-and-such. And some of those assumptions and understandings can be right on the money, and others not so much. But what you tell us is to think about some of the assumptions that maybe should not be made about ourselves. You write, there are also some assumptions that you've painted on throughout the years that aren't so useful. Assumptions about how someone like you can or cannot be. You slather on a layer of not smart enough, paint the trim with some too fat for that, and touch it up with a healthy splatter of that's just the way I am. The paint has dried now, and it's peeling. Tell us more about why you wanted to choose this particular image to describe the assumptions we make about ourselves and how some of those assumptions can really get in our way.
Yeah, well, first of all, it's so fun to hear you read that. That's really fun for me. That's one of the first images that we start with in the book. So this is this whole journey that we take through this, the places you'll go inspired storybook. So there's, you begin at the beginning in your body house, that's the first introduction of it right there. So you are in your life, a literal body house. Your body is your house that you live in, and there's no escaping it. So the question is, how are you doing the upkeep? How are you keeping the foundation solid? And what is the paint feeling like? And does it need an upgrade? So it was really important to me to try to allow people to understand that in a way that was going to be really visual and visceral, so that they could begin to think about what some of those elements are that they might want to change.
I really like that image, and I can see how it would be very, very helpful. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Sarah Hayes Coomer about her book, The Habit Trip, A Fill-in-the-Blank Journey to a Life on Purpose. I don't need to tell you, of all people, that a whole lot of books, at least vaguely like this, have been written before. I mean, we are in some respects drowning in such books. And
right.
I should think one of the real challenges for someone who wants to write still another such book is to write something that will be truly distinctive. And I think you've really done that. But I would really be curious to know what you thought about in terms of trying to craft this book in such a way that it would really matter and really say something distinctive that has not been said before.
You know, I have read so many of those books, both as part of my academic studies and just as a human being trying to feel better and heal. And I just got so tired of everything being so hard and being so miserable that, like, oh, we have to quit all the things. And I wanted to come at it from a place which really is supported by the scientific research. The most current research we have on behavioral change is that people don't change when you tell them what to do. So you go to your personal trainer, your nutritionist, your doctor, and they tell you, you need to do X, Y, Z, or even your spouse, you need to do this. And then your odds of following through on that, if somebody else tells you to do it, are just so incredibly slim. So that's why this is a fill in the blank, so that you are the expert and the hero in your own story, so that you can find your way through it and find what matters most to you, what are you really good at, and how can you use that information to address whatever issues you're trying to address in your life. So I really wanted to make it fun and exploratory.
I'd like you to explain a couple of facets of this book in terms of its framework. The sort of big layout is in three long sections: the situation, the solution, the payoff. Explain why the book has this fundamental framework and what you think is helpful about that framework.
Yeah, so I tell people that if they want to, they can read through the whole book before and then come back and start filling it in as they go, because getting the full picture of that arc can be really helpful with finding the motivation to do whatever you want to do. So the situation is the first section, and you can't make any changes until you know where you are and until you understand and accept and make peace with that. So you come at it from a place of observation rather than judgment. So where am I? What's not working? What are the routines and rituals that are happening every day in my life? And we explore 10 areas of life where you might find some of those answers in the situation. Then you find those questions about what matters and what you're good at. What are your favorite things? What do you really love? What pulls you forward? What has pulled you forward in the past in your life? So that's the first section. The solution is where you get to find your way. There's a lot of questions in this section, many of which I say, find what it is that you're focused on, do that, and then keep moving. Don't get bogged down in the whole thing. But in the solution, you're picking the area of life that is feeling, that's calling you to do something about it, and then figuring out the ways to do it, the nitty-gritty of those ways to do it. And you also make what I call an emergency plan in that section, where you pick basic reinforcements, where when you're in free fall and you can't see straight, these things you know will ground you and give you some peace along the way. And then the third section is the payoff, and that's really my favorite. That is where the chapters in that book are power, peace, and presence. So what kind of power would be unleashed in your life if you were able to quiet some of those voices of guilt and frustration and explore and play around? And then what kind of grounding and peace can you get by having the knowledge that you're capable of handling these things when they come up? And then who gets to be, you know, who gets to have swagger in this life? Who gets to stand in who they are and show up fully for what it is that they love? And that comes back to the caretaking and the being in this part of life where you're either raising kids or caring for parents or trying to work all the time, and just finding how can you show up fully in your life and what does that look like for you specifically?
I appreciate that one of the first chapters in the first section called The Situation is titled 10 Areas of Well-Being. And I really think it's helpful to have this right off the bat, because it helps us realize that when it comes to one's own well-being, we're talking about a lot of different things and many things that are deeply interconnected and that really should not be thought of in isolation from one another. And yet it's really just important to be reminded that there are a lot of things that contribute to our sense of well-being, and it's important to acknowledge that and to nurture them. How did you come up with this list of 10 areas of well-being?
So there's a lot of wellness wheels that you see. You know, if you look online, you can see a wellness wheel where it's a circle, and I have a version of this on my own website that shows all of these different areas. And I felt like a lot of the ones that I saw in my studies were not complete in my mind. Like, one area that doesn't get mentioned a lot is voice. Are you able to, A, know what you believe, and are you able, who in your life allows you to be yourself and to speak your mind openly and freely? Things like that where you're not, you know, people think of fitness and they think of diet and exercise as sort of that's what health and wellness is. But time, what are the rhythms of our days? What are the routines that happen again and again? How do we spend the tiny little increments of our time and how can we take some of those back? Money gets ignored a lot, money and career. And then there's others, relationships in your life. Sleep is a big one for people.
You take us through all kinds of different exercises that can be helpful. And one that I am especially interested to have you talk about a little bit is a set of pages that begins with the people you love. And then a couple pages later, your turn. Explain to our listeners what this exercise is all about and why it is so important to fully complete it.
So sometimes it's really hard to know what we're good at, what comes really naturally to us. So what I do is I sort of flip the script on you. So at the beginning, I don't ask you to try to figure out what you're good at, because these are the skill sets that have come naturally to you since you were little and that you can build on going forward. So I ask you to think about the people you love the most. What are the things about them that you appreciate, that you see them, the skills they exercise freely and effortlessly in their lives? And so it's pretty easy to identify those when you think about, you know, your mom or your best friend. So you can do that. And then I flip it back on the reader and then say, okay, what are these skills that you have? And there's an exercise in there where you can text these people that you love, and you can say, hey, these are the three strengths that I see in you. What would you say are my biggest strengths? So that if you're having a hard time figuring it out, often the people around you are able to see it a lot more clearly than you are.
I think that is such an interesting idea, and I appreciate that you're willing to do it, because I think sometimes we find books about this that seem to operate from the assumption that all of this is about me and that one of the mistakes we tend to make is looking too much at other people and envying them or copying them or emulating them in ways that sort of negate who we really are supposed to be. And I've always thought that's, although those are all potential pitfalls in the way we live our lives, I've always thought that that is going way too far and that we have a lot to learn from each other and especially from the people in our lives that we most admire.
Yeah, and you know, the core of this book is really about kindness. It's about kindness toward ourselves when we're trying to make these changes. And ultimately, by the end of the book, we zoom out and we see this common shared humanity that we all have. And what does it mean to be kind both to ourselves and to others? And how can we take that out into the world?
Let me just ask you real quick about a couple of other kind of intriguing moments in the book. Tell our listeners what the emoji volcano is.
So you've been in your town of favorite things, which has a canine mayor, which is really one of my favorite parts of the book. But so you've been exploring what are your favorite things in the world and in life, and they're all in this cozy, happy little town of favorite things. And then all of a sudden you look up and you see that there's this emoji volcano that's about to explode and destroy this town of favorite things. But earlier on we learned that whatever you discover in this town, and there's a Mr. Rogers quote in there that I take it from, but so whatever you've discovered in this town is something you can take with you to all phases, all areas of your life, no matter where you go. So these things, love can't be destroyed by this emoji volcano. So the volcano has devil horns, and it's about to explode. So it's an image of like, oh, we can't all just rest on our laurels once we found our favorite things. We have to figure out how to take them forward into whatever's coming around the bend.
Exactly. And I think you make that serious point in such a fun way. You do talk a bit in this book about sabotage, as in self-sabotage. What would be a couple of your chief words of warning for people to be aware of this possibility and, in a sense, to combat or counteract this tendency that probably just about all of us have at certain points in our lives?
Yeah, so it's completely common to say, okay, well, these are the things that matter to me the most. And in the process of trying to figure out how to work with those, we might undercut them. We might find ways of, like, for example, the example that I give in the book is that I had a struggle with body image and eating disorders when I was younger, and the food itself became a balm. Even though the eating disorder was extremely destructive, it was also supporting many of the things that worked for me and held me up in my life. So I had to start to say, okay, I'm just going to let that be what it is and try to find ways to fill in around it to support those same needs and those same values in healthier, more productive ways. And over time, those reinforcements coming from the outside start to sort of fill in your life and crowd out the bad things. And the bad things tend to pass a lot easier that way. So it's really, again, it's about kindness and lack of judgment so that you can approach this stuff with an open heart.
You, of course, envision people going on this full journey, start to finish. Is it possible to benefit from your book, even if one, for whatever reason, chooses not to do that?
Absolutely. In fact, I instruct at the beginning of the second section of the book, don't try to do all of this. Pick your topic, answer these questions, and then move on to the next. Or read through the whole book and then come back and do whatever you want to do. I think it's really, really important to pick and choose. You definitely can't tackle all the things. I think I threaten you with being eaten by dragons if you try to do that.
The book again is called The Habit Trip, A Fill-in-the-Blank Journey to a Life on Purpose. It's published by Running Press, the author Sarah Hayes Coomer. Sarah Hayes Coomer, thank you so much for giving the world this wonderful book. I can imagine it really being of great help to a lot of people as they enter this new year, hoping for a better days and for a better self. I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show Archive. We're spending this portion of WGTD's Morning Show with a woman by the name of Anna Sabino, who is actually the designer behind a highly regarded jewelry brand called Lucid New York. And Anna Sabino made the decision to, in a sense, leave a nice, solid life on Wall Street to embark on a, in a sense, more creative venture with her own jewelry collection. And she has done very, very well. But rather than just sit on her own success, she is really anxious to help others experience similar success in their own lives with their own creative ventures. So she is a certified career coach and has written a really interesting book called Your Creative Career, Turn Your Passion into a Fulfilling and Financially Rewarding Lifestyle, in which she shares some of her experiences with this new venture for her and offers some very practical suggestions for anybody who would like to launch something similar. And I'm excited to be able to speak with Anna Sabino about her very interesting story and very interesting book. Anna Sabino, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
I've sketched out just the barest minimum of your own life story, which is really so interesting. So let's give you a chance to describe it in a little more detail. Explain to our listeners what you were doing professionally and then what you decided to do quite differently then.
Sure. So I was on Wall Street and had a job as a market analyst, which basically involved sitting at a desk for 10 hours a day, not too much interaction with customers, etc. So I felt pretty limited. I felt that my growth, my professional growth, had like a box around it, that I couldn't really be in charge of my career, my future. So I started working on making a transition. I really felt this hunger of starting something on my own, on living on my own terms and being in charge of my time. So it took a while to get it off the ground, and I chose a safe approach because I think entrepreneurship in itself is pretty risky. So instead of just quitting my Wall Street job and cushy paycheck, I decided to start my creative career and still be on Wall Street for about a year until my jewelry brand Lucid New York took off.
And, of course, it has been a very, very exciting success with maybe one or two bumps along the way. But generally speaking, it has done very, very well. So as we explore your book and what you have to say to people, one of the most important things to talk about is this matter of creativity and the fact that, in your words, we are all creative. So But a lot of people don't tend to think of themselves as creative and tend to think that a creative venture like yours is something they couldn't possibly even think about doing. What is your notion of creativity and how do you want people to think about their own creativity?
So I do think that we are all creatives and we tap into our creativity daily, even deciding about our next career move, our next task, and approaching all that creatively, because we are not all the same. So we don't, for example, approach a transition or a change in the same way, and we don't even approach success the same. Although society is trying to condition us or pressure us into thinking of success in financial terms. But for some of us, it may be having more time to spend with our family or traveling or creating a location-independent lifestyle. So creativity comes into play as far as approaching our future steps, decision we make daily. It's all tapping into our resources, our creativity, our creative self.
So you suggest that really everybody needs to sort of ask themselves what they want to do with their life, and in many cases, it will be something more creative than maybe they are doing at the moment. And this is an important possibility to at least consider. In the course of doing that, one of your bits of advice is that people should stretch their walls. What do you mean by that? What is the importance of stretching your walls, and what are you saying there?
Yeah, Greg. So I think in our careers and lives, we tend to just keep repeating and doing the same thing over and over because it's just comfortable and we don't feel the push or the pressure. But taking a step back and stretching ourselves a bit, doing different things, taking on different projects, even if they don't seem to be comfortable at first, can be really good for our self-discovery, for our career, because we may discover what we like doing, what we don't like doing, what gives us true joy. But by doing, you know, repeating our routines and just, you know, sometimes we say we just go with the flow. But no, instead of going with the flow, taking a charge of our flow and choosing things that we can engage in, choosing new things, approaching new people, scheduling new coffee talks with people we've never met, reaching out can be extremely beneficial to our lifestyle design.
One of the things that you take a little time to talk about is that to do what, for instance, you did in terms of launching your own jewelry line, one of the things that you had to do was you had to be willing to accept the discomfort of being at zero. That is starting from nothing. And I think you're absolutely right when you say that when people talk about this, especially when people who are quite successful look back at the beginning and they will talk about, yeah, I started this from scratch. But they kind of breeze over the reality of what that really feels like to begin with, in a sense, not much of any money in the bank and no successes to build upon. I mean, it can be a very, very daunting situation. And I think you're telling people you need to be prepared for what that feels like to start from the ground up, starting at zero.
Yes, and it can be extremely lonely because not many people understand us, especially those with 9-to-5 jobs and steady paychecks who are not at zero, who don't have to build anything from scratch. And the most challenging, I think, in this stage that we all go through, not once, but multiple times in entrepreneurship, is that we don't know when that stage is going to end. It's not guaranteed that we have an end in mind, that there's a light at the end of the tunnel, that after, let's say, a month or a year, you know, we will succeed. We don't see it. We don't know it. So we are basically putting all this energy and effort, tremendous amount of time into something that we don't know the result of, and it's usually unpaid. So for those who transition from traditional jobs, it can be very challenging if they're used to getting paid for results right away, steady paychecks, weekly paychecks. But that's the price that we pay to truly build something that we want, to step into the career path that we've always wanted. It's not easy. It has roadblocks. It can be discouraging because nobody likes zero readers, zero followers, zero customers, but this is definitely a part of the process.
We're speaking with Anna Sabino about her book, Your Creative Career, Turn Your Passion into a Fulfilling and Financially Rewarding Lifestyle. Much of the book includes very practical advice, in part because, as you tell us, it isn't just about whether or not you are creatively talented, but whether or not you have the skills and the determination to do something with it. You write at one point, "We've always put talent on a pedestal, but it's actually it's application that matters. Our perseverance and commitment to our goals is more important than our talent. And I suppose if somebody sort of blunders into this kind of a venture thinking that just their sheer talent and creativity will be enough, they are likely to fail rather miserably.
Yes, I see it often that very talented people create pieces and then they don't know what to do with them. And the danger here is that they often think that the making process stops at creating. But nowadays, we all have to be involved after we created something. It's about distribution, about selling, marketing, personal branding, etc. And there are no excuses anymore. We can't say it's not for me, I'm not cut for business, I'm not cut for marketing. It's the space, the entrepreneurial space is just too competitive. The barriers of entry are very low. Everybody can start a business. So it's, we all have to be involved in all the steps of making it. It's not just creating and then waiting what's going to happen. Of course, you can get lucky, but in a lot of cases, you may just wait and wait and wait. So to take it into your hands, I would strongly suggest that you devote your energy into creating and at the same time into marketing and spreading the word about what you're offering.
I really appreciated some of your thoughts on avoiding creative block. And I know in some of the ventures in my own life that this has sometimes been an issue, or it's been hard for me to write or hard for me to compose music for one reason or another. You speak especially interestingly about this in a section titled Woman with Her Back to the Ocean View, in which you suggest that someone doing this should think about the space or the place in which they are doing their creative work. And maybe think about different kinds of spaces. How has this worked for you, and what suggestions do you have for people in terms of thinking about where geographically they should do this creative work?
Well, it's an exploration, definitely, because it's very personal. I personally have to be in movement. I do a lot of work on my phone. I have to change locations. But a lot of creatives, I think, make space in their homes or studios, and they almost force themselves to create things only there because their desk is pristine, everything is ready, and they are ready to write. And sometimes it may not happen because this may not be an environment for them. I know that for some, ambient noise works really well. So that's why we see so many creatives in coffee shops. And being in movement or taking, exercise breaks is very, very beneficial to the creative flow. But I would say if we feel not inspired in this space, even though it's our home, let's change it. Let's change it because it hasn't been working. And what I noticed, for me, I try not to focus on just 3 to 4 hours blocks of time, but I try to utilize even 15 to 20 minutes, even when I'm waiting in line or if I'm at a parking lot, and just tap into my creativity if it starts flowing. Why wait? These 20 minutes can be way more precious than 3 hours that we blocked for creating, just because we feel inspired and inspiration is precious. I grab it whenever I can. Mm-hmm.
You also have an interesting idea about how somebody who is engaged in this kind of creative venture might be really tempted to follow their own passion, which sounds really good, but can be sometimes quite impractical. If your passion is leading you to paint paintings or create pottery or write songs that nobody wants to purchase. And so you are, I think, suggesting or reminding us that you need to have some kind of a balance between your own passion and gaining a sense of what the world is interested in purchasing from you. What are your suggestions on keeping these two matters in balance? Two matters which might in some ways seem kind of diametrically opposed to each other.
Yeah, Greg. So let's assume here that we are talking about creative careers. We are not talking about creative hobbies, because if you have a hobby, you could do whatever you want. But I believe that if you want to start a business, a sustainable business, where you charge, you're able to, you know, to pay your bills with, you have to come up with a system, with a strategy. You have to keep your customers in mind, because ultimately they're going to be paying for your work. So it's not just about you and what you like and your family and friends, but it's total strangers who are going to be supporting your business by buying your pieces. So I believe that testing as early as you can and getting feedback, and that can be sometimes harsh, but if we transform the critiques into the feedback and distill the best out of it and just build upon it to create something that people want and want to pay for it, we set ourselves up for success. And I think engaging our customers in the early stages of creating is very important. I don't think creating in creating in solitude for a long time and then revealing, surprising, I don't think customers really do want to be surprised that much. They'd rather have a product that will solve their problems. They'd rather have a say in our creating. They want to have it customized. The surprise matters less than we think it does.
You also have some advice that I wanted to be sure to ask you about, because this was one of the biggest things in the book that had not really dawned on me until I read your book. And that comes down to the matter of timing. And you say that in many cases, creative people or people interested in launching a creative venture are sometimes really obsessed with the notion of being first, of being really early, ahead of the curve, which, of course, in at least certain cases, can be very, very advantageous. But more often than not, lunging at something early, prematurely, can lead to the downfall of a venture. What is your advice in terms of timing and this notion of being early versus being right?
So often it's our ego. We want to be inventors. We want to be looked up at. But I think striving to be first and rejecting ideas just because they've been done before is a risky strategy, because we can't. Let's put it that way. It's really risky if we're not. It's not risky for celebrities, for example, because they can, you know, start or invent anything they want. But to start from something from scratch is just, we don't know how it's going to be received. But let's say we are the second one in a row, then we can kind of ride the wave of the popular products that are already there. And there is nothing wrong with being second, third, fourth, with building upon the idea. Not all of us have to invent. Inventing is challenging in this world where it seems that everything has been invented. So what I say and what I truly believe in is it's not about the idea. It's about its execution. So if we are second or third, but if we actually execute better than the first person, we can actually be way more successful than the inventor.
I want to finish by having you talk about the importance of disavowing ourselves of the myth of the overnight genius. This myth is certainly pervasive in our culture, and I think you feel like this is really counterproductive when we let ourselves get caught up in this myth. Where did this myth come from, and why do we need to try to disengage ourselves from such a myth?
Yeah, so the media, social media, definitely feeds that dissatisfaction. We look at others and we see their followers, likes, popularity, platform, and we just think that everything just showed up to them like that. But we didn't see the struggle. We didn't see the tears and months or years of posting content or working towards some unknown goal, and I think just minding our own creative path and staying where we are and truly enjoying the process can be something that we should make ourselves aware of if we want to succeed in a creative field, because it can be extremely destructive to our own creative career, to our own life, to focus on the dissatisfaction, because there's always going to be somebody who started earlier, who has more resources. So all these excuses are stopping so many of us from starting businesses, writing books, and we don't see these things because of the insecurity of not being enough. So I would like to just conclude this thought saying we are enough. We have enough. We have everything that can take us to start what we want to start.
The book again is Your Creative Career, Turn Your Passion into a Fulfilling and Financially Rewarding Lifestyle. The book is published by Career Press, and you can find out even more information about Anna Sabino at her website, annasabino.com. Anna Sabino, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. I enjoyed our conversation, and I enjoyed your book.
Thank you, Greg.
Monday on The Morning Show, several different interviews, including one that we're rebroadcasting because of Martin Luther King Day. My conversation with Margot Lee Shetterly, author of Hidden Figures, that tells the inspiring story of those black women who worked at NASA in the 1950s and early 1960s. And you'll hear my conversation with Joylette Heilig, who is the daughter of Katherine Johnson, one of the women especially showcased in Hidden Figures. Joylette Heilig has written a book about her mom, a children's book called One Step Further. On Tuesday, in an interview that was originally scheduled for this past week, Laura Levitt, The Objects That Remain, a remarkable book about her search for some of the physical objects that were the only tangible evidence of the rape that she experienced while in college. And she draws interesting parallels to the importance of the physical objects or physical evidence that remains after the Holocaust. She explores all this fascinating and moving fashion in her book, The Objects That Remain. Wednesday will be Dr. Art Sear on Inauguration Day, offering his thoughts on recent events and the upcoming Joe Biden administration. Thursday, a look at animal cruelty through the eyes of Dr. Munish K. Batra, the author of a brand new book called Animal. And one week from today, Fawn Germer, the author of Coming Back, about what someone in mid to late career should do if they have suddenly lost their job. Support for the Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering an online master's degree program in health and wellness management. Learn advanced wellness program management skills and make a difference in a rewarding career in partnership with UW Extension. Details are available at uwp.edu. We're approaching 9 o'clock.